are back with episode 404 of Critical Myth. And nope, it is in fact found. Anyway, and tonight we have...
This is Edmund from Greenville, and I've got a secret to tell you, but I can only tell one of you, because it has to be very, very secret.
And this is Bronstone from Australia, and yeah, just tell John.
Please, don't tell me, and don't tell yourself, because if you don't tell yourself, then you don't have to worry about you telling anybody else. Or something like that. Anyway, we are going to go ahead and jump into some of the shows that we didn't cover the first hour for this week. And, well, before we do that, Edmund, why don't you tell the audience a secret?
The big, dark, nasty secret that we're trying to hide is that we will talk about anything and everything in these episodes, which means you will be horribly spoiled if you haven't seen them. But we certainly hope you have. That's why we've waited at least a week or so before we discuss these episodes of things.
Mm-hmm. Indeed we will. And, well, just as we did last time, we're going to go ahead and start off with Bronstone. What are we going to go ahead and talk about first?
My vote is to kick off with some Arrow.
That sounds like a great idea. Let's go ahead and do that. Let's run the promo.
How's it going with Roy?
You're late.
He's five kinds of angry.
Let me try hitting something that'll actually hit back.
Too soon.
Turner escaped.
A.K.A. Bronze Tiger.
You have one of your hoodies?
Do you seriously have to ask?
You want it all right? Yeah!
You have no idea what it is you're dealing with.
Oh, yeah.
We're just getting started.
Arrow, all new. This Wednesday at 8, 7 Central on the CW.
All right, and if you could do the recap, please.
Sure thing. Arrow, Season 2, Episode 12. Tremors. Arrow offers to train Roy and help him control his newfound strength. The Bronze Tiger escapes from prison and steals Malcolm's earthquake machine in order to sell it to the highest bidder. Laurel is disbarred. Moira is thrilled when Walter asks her to dinner. So, yeah. That's right, we do ratings first.
Yes, we do.
I'm getting better at it.
We are going to get better at it. That's fine. Don't worry. All right. What would you give this one, do you think? Bronstone.
This one was strong. I would... Yeah, I'm happy to go up to a 9.
Ooh, well, okay. And Edmund?
I think it was strong, but not that strong. I'm going to give it an 8.
Yes, and I'm with you on the 8. But Bronstone, tell us why you gave it a bit higher than an 8, obviously.
Just because there was no bit of the episode that I wasn't really, really enjoying, and that wasn't really intricately tied into the things that had to the things that had come before, and wasn't laying the groundwork for more awesome stuff to come. It was just such it, and there's a lot of episodes of Arrow like this where I'm watching. And there is. I'm never bored. I'm never questioning things. I don't feel like my suspension of disbelief is being overtly tested. I'm just having a really, really good time with the episode, and I think it's doing a really, really good job of all the things it sets out to do. Even the element that I would normally be the least happy with, which was the stuff about Laurel and her disbarment, because from the beginning, I've never thought she was as strong a character as a lot of the others in the ensemble, but I thought the actress in this episode did a much better job of portraying the that sense of like spiraling out of control and trying not to let it show. Walking that tightrope. I think she did a really, really good job. I think the way that they tied in, you know, her dad and her friend from the days at CNRI really helped cement that. It felt like a really, really I was cringing, but I was, in the way that you're supposed to cringe when you watch something like this. You're just like, oh, it's getting worse and worse and worse until, we finally get that big moment at the end, which I'm sort of kicking myself that I didn't realize sooner who it was that Ollie was calling. it seems so obvious in retrospect, but my first thought was that, you know, that he was calling her her father or someone. And it wasn't until the very end when I was just like, oh, okay, yeah, that's cool. That's a good way to handle this particular story development. There were a lot of really, really strong story developments here. The you know, obviously Sarah, you know, coming back, you know, letting Laurel know that she's alive. The development of the stuff with Moira and bringing Walter back and just sort of taking that character on a different arc. But the biggest one obviously being basically, you know, recruiting Roy onto Team Arrow and the hows and whys of that. And the fact that it's the fact that Roy has this, he's always had this sort of like hero worship of the Arrow for a long time. But it's not just the fact that the Arrow is sort of has to be so impersonal and has to be arm's length means that, you know, he was never going to be able to reach Roy the way that he needed to. And the fact that it just comes down to, do I trust this guy with the secret, or, you know, risk a major disaster? And it just seemed like he didn't really think about it. And that he knew how to reach Roy. He knew how to get Roy to cooperate. And the fact that Roy just immediately responds to, you know, the Oliver Queen that we've gotten to know over the past season and a half, the guy who is, you know, behind the masquerade and underneath the hood and stuff like that. It's just Roy responds to him infinitely better than he responded to the Arrow persona or to the, you know, billionaire playboy Oliver Queen persona. That I thought was really, really well handled. It was all I could have wanted out of covering that particular territory.
Hmm. Evan, how about you? Specifically, Roy coming onto Team Arrow, and then also Laurel's little adventure. Laurel, yes.
Yeah. Certainly the bringing Roy in. I did like the way that was handled. I also liked the way that there were times where the flashbacks of the island were really tying in, as opposed to last season when they at times seemed like they were enjoyable, but often were kind of two separate storylines going on. And this time it was very much showing, you know, this is what Slade was like when he first got it, and the shifts between full on rage and then getting through to him. And It was nice to see them back to using the two parts to really reinforce each other. I did enjoy, we were talking last episode about sort of nods to the fandom in Sherlock, and I did like the way Arrow did bring in that Team Arrow thing with Felicity going, well, I call us that sometimes. I thought that was a very nice, quick little nod without getting caught up in it. In terms of nods to the fandom, I've been showing that, yes, Stephen Amell actually can act while doing the Salmon Ladder. I thought it was also a fun little bit of eye candy.
I'm sorry, I can't even act like I can do the Salmon Ladder, let alone act while doing the Salmon Ladder.
Yes. That scene started, I was always doing it, then it's like, oh, and they're giving him lines, too. Okay.
You know that the first time he read that, he just like wanted to punch one of them. Come on. And then, just to show you his sense of humor, because one of the things I really like about the show is that Stephen Amell is really engages the fans well, especially on Facebook. Yeah. And he sent a picture of him doing the Salmon Ladder from this episode and basically said, "Ladies, I know that it's been a long wait, but yes, I'm going to have scenes like this from now through the end of the season."
Yeah, at least once an episode between now and the end of the season. And then goes on to apologize about the fact that in this particular shot, in this episode, he doesn't have armpit hair because they had to put, like, he accidentally, like, scratched himself just in the underarm, and they had to put, like, gauze over it and makeup, which meant that they had to take the armpit hair off. And therefore, so it didn't look even more ridiculous, they had to take the hair off the other armpit, and now he's one of those guys who doesn't have armpits, who doesn't have armpit hairs, and he hates those guys. it's just the funniest thing to read.
Yeah, he really gets into the fan service, let's put it that way. But at any rate,
as much as I enjoyed that, I mean, I personally found the Laurel stuff. I mean, it's nice that, yes, she's finally getting, you know, an actual character arc, but it's not necessarily Katie Cassidy, but more in terms of the writing, it felt very rote to me. This was sort of standard, TV addiction 101 that they were going through, and that I found a little disappointing given how well they've done at developing pretty much all the other characters. And when she started getting more attention, I was hoping it might be a little less conventional than this. But if this was just the episode where they just sort of went through all of the tropes of not admitting it, getting taken to a meeting, walking out, going off and getting drunk on your own, and then just leading to her seeing her sister and presumably, I don't think this show is going to do any of the silliness of like, oh, did I really see that, or was that just a hallucination while I was drunk and passed out? We do presume that Sarah is actually going to step in to try and pull her sister out of it, or to start pulling her sister out of this. I will cut them a little bit of slack for sort of taking us through this. They basically, that's the reason why for me it was an 8 and not a 9 was the Laurel stuff just felt a little too familiar to me. And then I guess the other part that not really knowing the DC canon except for just the top flight characters, I'm still having a hard time seeing Bronze Tiger as anything other than a low rent Wolverine. So
I was gonna get into that because that was actually.
See, I thought he was a lot better this episode than in the first appearance. I'm the only one who thought that. He did a better job of seeming dangerous. I was not expecting him to be as League of Shadows-esque kind of badass or anything, but I thought they did a much better job of presenting him as a threat and as a villain worth bringing back than they did in the previous appearance.
That moment during the fight where he basically has him from behind, leaps down, and yes, I know it's part of that sort of convention where they're going to commercial, and but he's basically got Oliver stabbed through the back, and you come back from commercial, and then it's just a quick, he does some twist or turn or whatever. It just seemed to me that it was one of those cases where the fight choreography, they just ended up a little bit too much of where, no, he has him dead to rights and then he gets out of it. So that was really the main thing. What did you think, John, since I think you have a little more background on the character than I do?
Not much. I just really didn't like the character. I thought that there was... It's kind of like, for every really good character that they have and that they bring in from the comics continuity, then they have like a... like the Count. Or like Bronze Tiger. I mean, it just doesn't work for me at all. So, yeah, that's kind of where...
Well, even Shrapnel was a little underserved and underdeveloped, too. So.
Right, exactly. So if it wasn't for a couple things, the whole thing at the end with Amanda Waller and the hint that she's putting together the Suicide Squad, which is going to be an interesting turn of events, to say the least, and also this hint that everything that Laurel is going through is in fact going to tie into Laurel becoming Black Canary, presumably because her actions forced both, Sarah and it sounds like possibly from, again, spoilers, everyone, from the promo, sounds like Dinah Lance is coming back to help deal with all of this. So, how the legacy of both mother and sister drive her perhaps towards something else again, maybe plays into that whole thing that I was noticing back in the when they were giving the whole, what do you want to call it, the PR about Black Canary, and about there's going to be this person's going to be very important in her life. And it sounds to me like, or in Oliver's life, and yet they said at one point, oh yeah, the new actress is going to play Black Canary and she's going to be very important in his life. And now, it's like, yes, here's where we see where Black Canary could in fact be important to Oliver's life, yet not be Sarah and not be the actress, right? Because it would be Laurel. So yeah, it's kind of fitting a pattern, and it's okay in that regard, but I do feel like this was kind of taking a very conventional direction with the whole alcoholism, drug addiction thing, as you said. So, okay, Bronstein, any last thoughts on this one?
Just that apparently I had less problems with it than you guys did. But yeah, I no other real points, just that I thought this episode was insanely well put together.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In which case, let's go ahead and then take our Mitch. Well, no, it's actually not time for that. Edmund, I think it's actually time for you to go ahead and pick our next topic.
Let's see. Let's talk about Helix.
Okay, let's go ahead then and run the promo.
Stay on point here. A lot of people in for a lot of suffering if we don't step it up.
The CDC hasn't abandoned us. They'll be back as soon as they figure out what's going on.
Why would anyone want to put that inside of us?
I don't have a clue. We'll take this down.
You made a virus that does everything other than what you advertised.
You don't have the intellectual capacity to evaluate my work.
Helix. New episode Friday at 10. Exclusively on Showcase.
All right. And if you could do the recap.
This is Helix Season 1, Episode 4, Single Strand. Alan and the team deal with secrets and suspicion as the crisis heightens and deadly consequences follow. Meanwhile, Walker tries to survive on Level R.
Hmm. And what would you give this?
That's an interesting question on this one. Let's say I'm between a 6 and a 7, and I'm going to stick with the 6.
Okay. And Bronstein, how about you?
Yeah, I think I'd go with 6 as well.
Okay. And I don't know. I'm going to have to go with, I think, a 7 on this one. I'm a little more favorable towards it. Well, we might as well get into a little bit of why that is. I mean, we're not at dead average. You're a little bit below. This doesn't seem like it's going to be a major topic. This show in particular is kind of becoming a little bit disappointing. But, Edmund, why would you give this a 6?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing that got to me about this one was, the description is talking about Alan and the team, and we basically wind up with this episode where we've got everybody off on their own, keeping secrets from each other, and not just because they're trapped on Level R, but got our young scientist sort of harboring the possibly infected woman, or we think pretty much definitely an infected woman. When her tumor came up was just the complete eye roll moment for me. just in terms of, you know, okay, so we have to introduce this now just to heighten the tension. And yes, I understand. I'm sure she's ambitious and she wants to get ahead of the CDC, but would you really keep this a secret? But that aside, I mean, okay, for dramatic reasons, I can see that being a thing. Certainly, I mean, giving Billy Campbell a chance to bond with his brother and go over their past issues. I mean, that was certainly good stuff from a acting and writing standpoint. I did enjoy that. But again, it's like it was kind of weird how it was just all this stuff going on different parts of the station, and I wasn't feeling much. It was sort of the whole point that no, there isn't any teamwork going on. Yes, that's contributing to why everything is falling apart. But certainly, this trend of these supposedly top class scientists and top class people at dealing with epidemics and the personal conflicts and relationships that that those entail, we're really not seeing much of that. And at this point, it's really starting to annoy me. And of course, the biggest example was, you know, even though, yes, apparently our military guy is, it certainly seems highly versed in infiltration and counterintelligence and manipulating people, but the fact that he managed to keep Doreen from letting slip what, you know, actually letting anybody know what she found, and the two of them having forming their own little team, which then just worked in his favor when he was able to offer, which I've been sort of seeing coming for a while, and was also just a little bit annoyed because I was kind of liking the character, and also just the whole TV trope of like, oh, okay, so all the good-looking people are, you know, are going to survive, but of course the, you know, slightly geeky, less attractive one is the one who we can often have eaten by rats. So I didn't enjoy seeing that trope playing out.
That's an awfully terrible way to put it, but actually accurate. All right, Bronstone, how about you? I mean, what would you say is why you would give this a 6?
I felt like it was I don't know. I was really engaged with the first couple of episodes. I think it did a really, really good job of presenting mystery and tension and just rooting it all in the procedure of the CDC and all that kind of stuff like that. And in this episode, the only bit that felt vaguely original, well, not necessarily original, but the only bit that I felt like it vaguely surprised me and felt like that there was, you know, I really wanted to see where it went was the actions of the guy who was in charge of the base, who... Mm-hmm. You know, bits and pieces have been revealed to suggest that there's a lot more to this guy than what he presents. And in this episode in particular, we see the way that he's so methodically bloodthirsty, I'd say. And I found that was really engaging. But everything else just struck me as poor attempts at creating tension or poor attempts at creating mystery.
Hmm.
They I could see what they were trying to do, but it just didn't engage me.
Yeah, two things kind of gave this a little bit of a bump up for me to at least an average episode. The first was the, as you said, the mystery of what's going on with the guy behind all of this, and what's he really up to down here. And it certainly seems like he's got somebody's military, involved in a conspiracy to do something, and you know that something perhaps aligning a little bit with the whole Andromeda strain theme that I feel is going on here is that either they genetically created something new by creating a new genome, or they're dealing with some kind of alien genetics or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking towards, and that the base doctor is. Not just in charge of this research, but I'm starting to suspect that he's also slightly the source, perhaps, or whatnot. So again, he continues to be the thing in this episode. He was the thing that was the one thing that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. So this one came in at below average, and right now the show is kind of limping along at a 6.5, which is somewhat surprising considering how much anticipation there was for this show. At least as far as I can recall there being. But there we are. We're going to go ahead then and move into our mid-show break, so stay tuned.
Thank you.
All right, and we are back, and that means that it's time for Bronstum to choose the next topic. What are you going to give us here?
I think it'll probably have to be the latest Lost Girl.
Okay, sounds good to me. Let's go ahead and run the promo.
Have you seen a succubus running through these woods?
Sunday on Showcase, the search begins.
We're looking for a woman. Her name is Bo. Where is she?
My family is haunted.
People my family keep dying.
He locks me in a box. He's sick.
But will they find her?
What the hell are you doing down here?
Before it's too late.
Kill them. Kill them all.
You picked the wrong girl to screw over.
Lost Girl. New episode Sunday at 10, exclusively on Showcase, where character is everything.
Okay, and if you could do the recap.
I can probably manage that. Lost Girl, Season 4, Episode 3, Lovers Apart. Dyson rushes to be by Bo's side when she puts her life on the line to save a haunted family. At the same time, Lauren finds, much to her dismay, that she can no longer outrun her past.
Okay, and what would you give this episode, or what did you give this episode, I guess?
In the review, I gave this one a 6 out of 10.
Uh-huh, okay. And, Edmund, what would you give it?
I would actually give it a 7.
Okay. And this one, I'm going to have to agree with Bronstum on. But, Bronstum, why don't you quickly, why this was a 6, in your opinion?
Why it was a 6, it was because it didn't help that we'd had some really, really fantastic episodes just previously, but the main problem was that the thing that was presented as the A story that took up the majority of the screen time was just bad.
Mm-hmm.
It was boring to the point where just talking about it, I'm yawning. It went beyond just I'm not that interested and well into why am I watching this? Why is it deemed that I should find this, you know, interesting to watch, especially when they'd done such a much better job in the previous couple episodes. They had good storylines and whatnot that they could pick up and work on. And instead, it's this.
Hmm. Now, Edmund, why would you give it a 7 versus a 6?
Yeah. I guess for me, I felt like this was starting to swing us back to the elements we're more used to. I mean, actually having I'll admit, I mean, the actual case itself, yes, was not a huge stretch or, you know, or all that interesting necessarily, but actually having Bo back working a case. And then I guess the thing for me was the stuff that was going on sort of more on the peripheries, I was enjoying quite a bit. I mean, both the Morrigan's return and coming back basically badder than ever, deliberately and outspokenly so, I thought was because Vex is the Morrigan just didn't really make sense, so it was nice to see that was being corrected very quickly, the whole subplot with Lauren and the back and forth with the other waitress. I part of this may be that part of what I loved in the early seasons was that triangle between Lauren and Dyson and Bo, and seeing these elements that are looking like that is going to be back in play. I guess are the things that made me overlook the central story and keep this one average for me. So I'll chalk it up to the side dishes as opposed to the main dish.
Okay, I mean, for me, this continued what was irritating to me in the previous episode, where there was this stuff going on with this transcendental train or whatever, and it made very little sense. We had the elemental that came somewhat out of nowhere. So on top of that, you've got this situation with Bo that just wasn't very engaging. It was just there. and it just really didn't come across very well at all, especially in light of everything else. It just felt this continued what the previous episode was doing in terms of just taking all the good things about the premiere and just kind of putting it in a blender and mashing it up in ways that just didn't really gel. At least not yet. I gave this a 6. The season is still on track to be definitely better than the second season and a bit better than the third. So there's steady improvement going on, but yeah, this is a rough episode for me. Anything else really to say about Lost Girl here?
The other thing I just realized was that also the dynamic with the daughter being sort of the surrogate Kenzie, I did also enjoy, and just having a little preview taste, we presume, of the Bo and Kenzie back and forth that we love, and I thought the actress did a pretty decent job actually of evoking Kenzie, but in a lighter version. So
I wasn't happy with any of the actors playing the family, and I thought it was a bad idea to draw so much comparison between the girl and Kenzie, because I didn't think she was nearly as fun as Kenzie, and it was just kept reminding us that the best thing about the show isn't in this, doesn't seem to be in this episode.
Thank you. That was exactly what my retort was going to be, is that, but it wasn't Kenzie. I want my Ksenia solo, thank you very much. But at any rate, let's go ahead then and wrap up on Lost Girl. A little bit of a misstep there. And let's turn our attention to, Edmund, what do you want to go with here?
There appears to be two choices, kind of. let's talk about Elementary.
Well, I guess the first question would be, is that are you both up on the most recent Elementary?
I am indeed.
Okay, then that would answer that question. Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and run the promo then.
New Thursday.
Why are you cutting up the case file?
I am reducing it to digestible chunks. It's one case Sherlock Holmes couldn't solve.
I remember it very well. Very well. Vaguely.
But new clues.
People would kill to get their hands on this.
We'll unearth a mystery.
You think there's something in there?
65 million years in the making.
I think this is a skeleton.
The dinosaur in the backyard did indeed escape my notice.
A new Elementary, CBS Thursday.
Okay, and the recap, please, Edmund.
This is Elementary, Season 2, Episode 14, Dead Clade Walking. Watson examines one of Sherlock's cold cases and discovers that an unsolved murder is connected to a rare prehistoric fossil. Meanwhile, Holmes enters uncharted territory when his duties as a sobriety sponsor cross his personal boundaries.
Okay, and what would you give this one?
I would give this one an 8.
Okay. And Bronstam?
Oh, I wouldn't go that high. I'd take it down to a 7.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead then. And Edmund, what gave you this the 8 in your opinion?
For me, it was this thing they've been doing for a while now this season of trying to expand the universe a little bit and playing up both Watson's skills as a detective and then also just giving Sherlock a little more depth and actually going with really delving into this whole thing of him being a sponsor and the effects of his own drug addiction on the cases, which is brought up by the cold case that Watson is delving into, and then him actually having to deal with being a sponsor and having to, as they say, cross his personal boundaries, actually having to involve himself personally with somebody and deal with the frustrations of that, and but also the potential rewards that can come of it. So it was a case of I felt it was a little forced in some of the earlier episodes, and it felt more organic this time in terms of the setup. And And then I like the way that they were able to meld both Watson's increasing abilities, where she's able to go to dig up this cold case, bring her sensibilities to it, but also the whole element of Sherlock discovering that, yes, this is something that one of the cases he did when he was in the depths of his addiction, and there were things he missed. There were things that he didn't bring to the case that he can now, and certainly now as part of this partnership, actually take that case and finally bring it through to its end. So it was in terms of those background character parts of the episode that I felt they were excelling with this one. But what did you think, Bronstone?
That sort of stuff going on in the background, in the periphery of episodes, it can only excuse so much of the main story being just the usual, really pedestrian, really, you know, tried and true, you know, case of the week, A story kind of thing. You know, the majority of the running time here was devoted to the kind of thing that we see on television every week. And when they had chances to sort of diverge a bit and have it be more weird and Holmes, you know, Holmesian, they sort of went back more in the direction of, you know, there's a dead body and some weird clues, and we're just going to investigate it like it's CSI or Law and Order or whatnot. And that tends to rub me that's always going to rub me the wrong way a little bit about this. About Elementary. But where we did get to focus on those bits that are normally periphery and stuff like that, I quite enjoyed it. I quite like the, like you said, they're developing Watson a lot. From where she was, you know, a season ago, she's an incredibly competent detective in her own right. Like, you could see her, you could see this version of Watson basically, you know, being the protagonist of some other CBS crime show.
Yes.
Like, yeah, and that's, you know, the quality of the way that she's presented. They continue to bring in these, like, interesting little, you know, one-shot side characters who have some particular branch of knowledge that's useful for the case, and are just sort of around long enough to be quirky and give exposition and then leave again, and that could be really annoying, but I don't know, I tend to find it a bit fun. And I do like what they're doing with Holmes and his stuff with his sponsor, because I was wondering how they were going to play that out, and just him really being concerned about how he's going to do and about being responsible for someone else. And there's a subtext of sort of him coming to appreciate really how tough a job Watson had before she decided to sign on as a detective proper. Those bits were strong, but so rarely are there enough of those bits to make me appreciate the whole episode. Because 9 times out of 10, it feels like the mystery that takes up most of the airtime, that's at the center of the episode, is just, it's just same old humdrum and has very little to do with the things I find genuinely interesting about the show.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, no, I can't. I can't disagree with that. I guess it's just a question of what the emphasis of when I'm watching. It was this was a case of I think, to a certain extent, I may have kind of lowered my expectations of what I expect the cases to be. I think this is one area where, Elementary has certainly stepped out of Sherlock's shadow in terms of establishing its own universe and its own characters. I think this is one case where the having to fill 20-plus episodes versus having to just do 3 mini-movies does work to Elementary's detriment, that it is very hard to keep having those Holmesian cases, and I've just kind of, I think I've reached the point where I'm accepting that's going to be the case, and when they do concentrate more on the background character stuff like they did this episode, I'm willing to give them the recognition for it.
See, I'm getting more and more annoyed about it. I think it's just, every single episode, it opens with, you know, they show up to a crime scene, NYPD's blocked everything off, Bell or Gregson talks them through the crime scene, and then they start investigating. Right. And it's no different to any other kind of procedural show. I mean, one of the things about the canon was that not every case they investigated was a murder, and the ones that they got brought in on were the ones that were just so weird that Scotland Yard... just, we're just smacking their heads against the wall, trying to come up with even a vague avenue for investigation. And those are only relatively small around it. And the rest of them were just people off the street who wandered into Baker Street with some problem. And Holmes would dismiss the ones that sounded that were too pedestrian, but he took the ones that were just wacky and strange because they posed, like a real puzzle. One of them was, one of the more famous stories, the Redheaded League, was just about a guy who came in off the street. Like, I had this weird job for about 3 months where they paid me to go and sit in this room and copy out pages from an encyclopedia. And then after the 3 months, they said, right, contract's up, on your way. And Holmes was just like, that's weird. I must investigate. There's no sense of anything like that in Elementary. And Elementary could do that in a way that Sherlock, can't. Because Sherlock is hour and a half movies. They need to be, very big adventures and sort of stuff like that, justify the longer running time, the higher production value. In Sign of Three, we had all these little snippets of weird and wacky adventures, and we didn't have to see the whole thing. We just saw enough to know that it was something strange and cool, and we got a sense of the kind of stuff that Holmes likes to investigate. Elementary could do that. It could be a very different kind of procedural detective show because it's not every week there's just a body on the floor. It's he's sort of sitting there in his chair in the sitting room or something like that, waiting for people to come in and give him strange problems to solve. I want to see that.
No, you just made me realize that's the key element that they did strip out of the Holmes canon for this version is that. No, he is this anonymous guy who is just a consultant for Scotland Yard and the NYPD. He doesn't have a public persona the way he does in the original canon or in Sherlock. So he doesn't have people coming to him saying, oh, you're the great Sherlock Holmes. I need you to solve this for me.
It doesn't even have to be the great Sherlock Holmes. It could just be he's got some avenue. He's got an ad up on Craigslist or he runs a classified or something like that. Or just word of mouth is getting around, that kind of thing. Like you said, all he does here is just consult for the statement that it was in an episode earlier in the season and just frustrated me all to hell was when he's talking about the fact that Holmes is considering whether or not to move back to London or say anything, and he talks about the fact that he's he prefers to take the more interesting case, the cases and stuff like that. There are ones that pay well and sort of stuff like that, but he chooses to do the pro bono work with the NYPD because it's more interesting. I'm just smacking my head like, no, it's not.
Not yes.
No, it's. There's been just a tiny, tiny handful of episodes that have felt like mysteries worthy of the great Sherlock Holmes, and even then, I think so few of them are. So few of them are anything other than just the usual. There's a body on the floor.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. I was saying the great Sherlock Holmes just in terms of the standard canon, but even within the framework of the show they've built, the fact that he is so conversant on the internet and he's in and out of chat rooms and things, it doesn't have to be, Watson's blog the way it is in Sherlock, but I could see where he would start developing a following or people becoming aware of him.
Some awareness, just something that people talk about on sort of wacky blogs or people who make a vidcast just tell this funny story about that they work at they're a receptionist at a building, and just one day this weird British guy showed up and started asking really, really wacky questions, and he said he was a consulting detective. What the hell is that? That sort of thing. They're just I'm not a fan of the idea of fidelity to the source material for the sake of having fidelity to the source material. I think every adaptation of any kind of thing needs to stand on its own as its own, it needs to be a strong work in its own right, and it needs a kind of chance to sort of do its own thing, be a bit different from everything else, justify its own existence. But this is really a case where the show and the people making the show could... The show as a whole would really, really step up and become something that could compete with the BBC Sherlock if they took that page out of the canon and dug into this notion of Sherlock Holmes isn't a homicide detective. That's basically right. How they portray him in the show. He's a homicide detective who happens to live in a weird brownstone and be English. They need to sort of play up that idea that he's just this consulting. He's created this profession as an excuse to have access to and be able to solve the strangest puzzles he can find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And now that we've had this discussion, I'm not going to cut them as much slack as I have been.
Yeah, I haven't been cutting them that much slack relative to Bronstone, but still, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, no, about that.
In elementary, we're coming for you.
Yes.
Oh, boy. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there's also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical Myth's use of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time...